I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness. Your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Tom Campbell, and we're going to talk about his book, My Big Toe, or My Big Theory of Everything. How are you, Tom?
I'm just fine, Eva. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for taking the time to come on my show tonight. Before we get started, why don't you tell me a little bit about you and how you got to where you are and where people can find you?
Okay. Well, as you said, I'm Tom Campbell, and I'm a physicist. And I have written a book called My Big Toe. Actually, it's three books. It's a trilogy. And I began my career as a normal kind of physicist doing physics. I'd just gotten out of graduate school, and I happened to run into Bob Monroe. And at the time I ran into Bob Monroe, Bob was just in the process of putting together a building in which he wanted to build a laboratory to study consciousness. Now, I don't know if your readers know about Bob Monroe, but he wrote Journeys Out of the Body and then Far Journeys, and I think it was a set of three books. The Ultimate Journey was the last one. Bob was a person who had spontaneous out-of-body experiences, and being a bit of an engineer at heart, he studied them, played with them, experimented with them, and he wanted to study consciousness because he wanted to make this real. He wanted to make it science. You know, he didn't just want to be the strange old guy who, you know, had funny experiences. He wanted this to be something that, you know, could be studied, understood, and taught, something that was real. So he wanted to study it, and I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and he needed some scientists to help him get his lab going. All he had was a shell, and I had just started a job and had the free time and very interested. I had meditated, so I understood something about the dimensions of mind. So I jumped at the chance and said, Bob, if you will teach me what you know, I will be, I'll work for free and be your scientist and help you get this lab going. And he agreed to that, so that started a long decade, actually more than a decade-long relationship between Bob and I, where I would come out to his lab. It wasn't just me, but myself and others. Dennis Menerick was my cohort in this. He was an electrical engineer. And we would come out and build equipment and set up the lab, and then he would come up later and he would start to teach us what he knew about it. And after about 2 or 3 years of that, Dennis and I both got to where we could explore and travel in that larger reality system. The out-of-body was something that we could do whenever we wanted and kind of go where we wanted. So we started experimenting with it as well. So that's kind of how I got involved in it. And I have always approached my experiences as a scientist. So I always have to verify it's real and it's not just something in my head. I always have to experiment with it and find out, how does it work? What are the limitations? You know, what does this mean? Why is it like this? So I've been doing this now for about 45 years, I guess. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I finally figured out that I knew enough about it to talk to others. So I wrote the books. So that's kind of the short story of how I got here.
Just out of curiosity, what are you doing now, just briefly? Are you working somewhere? Are you doing this all the time?
Yeah, I work for NASA. I'm a consultant, and I work for NASA doing risk analysis for large systems.
Okay.
So that's what I do. The job basically is to make sure that the NASA mission and the astronauts survive. So what could go wrong, and if so, how can we fix it, and what can we do about it? So
I would imagine NASA wants a stable person that's not a nut. So
that's
a lot about
you. Oh yeah, you know I live, I guess, two lives in a way. I don't mix the two a whole lot. When I'm at NASA and before I was doing other job, I'm a physicist, and I make mathematical models and do physics and that sort of thing. But I don't mix the larger consciousness system with that sort of thing, right? They couldn't have someone who was unstable and goofy doing that sort of work.
So let's start off with, what is your definition of consciousness, so we can make sure that everybody's on the same page about what you're talking about?
Okay. To begin with, that's a hard question, and it's not hard so much because of the answer. I can give you a good answer, but it's hard because consciousness is the super system. Consciousness is the only thing that's fundamental. Everything else is virtual. Okay, everything else is a derivative of consciousness. So here in our physical reality, we are a derivative of consciousness. So to describe what consciousness is from the language and the perspective of the subset, which is this physical reality, is difficult to do. You're asking the little picture to describe the big picture, and the little picture doesn't have that big of a view to do that. Yeah, I can tell you that, you know, the answer to that question probably won't make sense until we've had a chance to talk about some other things and flesh out what I mean by it. But consciousness is information. Consciousness is a digital information field. It is a system of information that is aware. It has memory. It processes data. And it is self-changing. It can modify itself, okay? And it has a purpose. So you take all of those things together, and that's fundamentally what consciousness is. Now, as I've said that, let me also say that that is a metaphor, okay? We can only talk, when we're using our language, we can only talk in terms of symbols and metaphors. So that is a metaphor. That's a good description, but... Just keep in mind, we're talking metaphorically here.
I was looking for something like that because I think a problem exists with a lot of scientists from every field that when that word is used, they think that it's synonymous with awareness. And I think that it's so much more than just being aware.
Oh, yes. Consciousness is like
the thing.
They
don't get that word. They don't understand that.
Yeah, consciousness is the thing itself. It's the creator, if you will. It's the fundamental thing from which all else is derived. And awareness is, well, it's just awareness. It's how much of that do you understand? How much of that can you take in? What's the perspective that you have? Awareness is a function of your understanding and perspective. And awareness grows.
All right. Now, I've got about 25 questions that I want to ask you. And,
okay.
I'm basing these questions both from reading your book as well as interviewing 50 other people from around the world. So I'm going to ask you at some times about your research because I definitely want to know about your out-of-body spirits and I want to ask about binaural beats and things like that. But I also want these questions because I'm trying to gather all of the questions that I can and the response from luminaries in one place, you know, for long-term research purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Well, that's a lot of questions to go over in just an hour, so they're going to have to be pretty short, top-level answers that may be hard to understand without a lot of other discussion behind them.
I totally agree. You might have to come back. Okay. The next question is, do you believe that there are gradients in consciousness? And if you do, what does that mean to you?
Gradients in consciousness.
You know, everybody that walks around sees the world a different way. Is that a gradient in consciousness? You know, why do we all not accept the bigger picture?
No, that's not a gradient in consciousness. That's a gradient in awareness. We all have different levels of awareness. Consciousness again is the creator. It's a fundamental thing. It's not something that it's something we are. And it's what creates this reality. We can discuss, if you like, how this physical reality gets created by consciousness.
Oh, that's going to be one of my questions, yeah.
Okay, well, good.
You can go ahead and start there if you want, and I'll ask questions as we go.
Okay, well, just go on. So now awareness comes in gradients. There's all sorts of levels of awareness of what's going on and what you know, what's our purpose? What are we doing? How aware are we of our consciousness and what consciousness is? Many different gradients and levels of awareness. Now, our consciousness is evolving. Okay, the larger consciousness system is evolving. Our particular individual consciousness is evolving. And in any evolving thing, there's all sorts of different, states or levels, if you will, of evolution. So some are more evolved than others as far as their meeting the purpose and function of consciousness.
Okay, if consciousness is all there is, and I personally agree with you on that, so don't think I'm trying to trick you here, but if it's all there is, how does it segregate itself?
Okay,
does
consciousness.
That make sense?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. How is we're all one, but yet we're individual, is what you're asking.
Yes.
As I said, consciousness is basically information. Okay, but it has those characteristics of information that I described. So it's information. Think of it as an information system. Now, an information system can partition off parts of itself very easily. It can take part of its bits, if you will, part of its information. You can duplicate information. An information system can do anything, like a digital computer can do. Information is just coded bits, ones and zeros at the basic level. So information can be put in file folders, that are separate. There's all sorts of ways that you can separate off chunks of information. Now, why would the consciousness system want to do that? Well, evolution, as I said, the consciousness is evolving, and evolution comes through experience. In order to experience, you could have just one consciousness system experiencing itself, but that doesn't lead to a lot of interesting choices that lead to consciousness evolution. So to help its evolution, it breaks itself into pieces, and those pieces interact. So that's kind of the short story of what we are, our consciousness, why we're a subset, and that's how it gets broken out. It's just information.
Do you have any idea how that happens from physics? Or from a scientific perspective?
Well, what we call in physics the motive force, it's not really a force, but the thing that makes changes in consciousness in this information system is intent. Okay, conscious intent is what moves things, changes data, creates boundaries. So, yes, it's done by intent. The larger system is just an evolving system like any system. And it wants to make its evolution more efficient and more useful, and it's evolving, by the way, toward love, which is, in physics terms, decreased entropy in the information system. And that's probably a half-hour discussion all by itself. So it breaks itself into pieces just like cells broke themselves into pieces. They divided up. We had one-celled beings, and then we had multi-celled beings, and then after that, the cells divided into various functional things. Some were the sensors, some were the locomotion parts, the little tentacles, or I guess eventually legs and feet, and some was the nervous system. So they differentiated just because that was more survivable, and that was part of their evolutionary path. The same with consciousness. It evolved us. It evolved itself into pieces in order to facilitate its own evolution.
Can you discuss how mass consciousness and individual consciousness differentiates themselves? First of all, why is there that mass consciousness, and how does it happen? And then, does the individual consciousness break off from the mass consciousness? How does that work?
You have all consciousness is individual. We will say you have individual consciousness, but those individual consciousnesses are all netted. This is an information system. They're all talking to each other. They're all communicating, not necessarily at an intellectual level, but every consciousness is on the net. Okay, sort of like on the internet, like they're all web pages on the net, that sort of thing. So when you have consciousness interacting, now they may interact like we do now. We're speaking to each other, so it's acoustic waves, and we're decoding those acoustic waves. but we're also interacting in a non-physical level. There's information passing back between us and between your listeners and everybody that's kind of involved in this on a level that's not physical. That's just natural part of consciousness. It communicates. So what happens is that you have these individual consciousnesses, and they begin to influence each other. So the influencing each other produces a kind of a vector sum, if you will, of all the consciousness there. Now, if you get a mob together, then you get mob consciousness, and that tends to, you know, descend to the lowest common denominator among all the people taking part in it. If you have a bunch of consciousness together and they're growing, they're learning, they're caring, then that also pulls up the consciousness level of that group of people. So it's like the vector sum of all the consciousness, but it's an influence between these. So it's not like the group consciousness is a separate consciousness of its own. It's just the vector sum of all of its component, if it's all of its people.
Okay.
So it's really individual consciousness is what consciousness is, but because of the influence and communication between consciousness, they do act and influence each other as a group.
Okay. Do you believe that we have free will? And also, well, let me let you answer that first.
Okay.
And define free will, please, if you would. What is that?
Sure. The answer to that is, of course, we have free will. We have to have free will because we're conscious. Consciousness and free will are logical necessities for each other. You cannot have consciousness without free will. You cannot have free will without consciousness. Those two things are logically connected. They're logically necessary. Okay, so, and I derive that logic in the books. If any of your readers really would like to see how that progresses and what the logical derivation is, but of course there's free will. Now, how do you define free will? Well, I define a thing called decision space, and decision space is all those choices that we get to make. Growth is about choices. It's how your intent meets a choice. You have choices to make, and that intent will make that choice for a reason. Okay, that's your intention is kind of the reason. And of all the choices you have in your decision space, and that's not necessarily all the choices there are. Your decision space may be limited because your awareness is limited. So you have though these choices. You have N choices, and you get to pick one of them. So somebody accidentally steps on your toe, and one of your choices is to reach out and smack them. Another choice would be to say, excuse me, you know, you're on my toe. Another would be to push them off of you. You know, another would be just to stand there and grit your teeth and not say anything because you wouldn't want to embarrass them. So you have all these choices of how you could act, and you'll pick one based on how you are, what's inside of you. And that's your free will, gets to pick any of those. And how you act either helps you along in your evolution or helps you de-evolve or doesn't change you at all. So it's through those choices that consciousness changes itself or has the opportunity to change itself.
Now here I have a question, and it's a story that my teacher told me one time. Imagine that you're a three-year-old in the back seat of a car, and you're strapped into a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel, and you think that you're driving that steering wheel, but Source or God or the Force or whatever you want to call it is in the front seat driving the real car. And you get down to the stop sign and you say, I'm going to the playground and it's on the right, and Source says, nope, I'm going to the grocery store and it's on the left.
Mm-hmm.
Whose steering wheel is going to work?
Well, obviously in that scenario, the three-year-old sitting in the back with the little plastic steering wheel is not going to work.
Exactly. So what my question is here, do we have free will to place intention, or do we really have complete free will?
Oh, we have free will to do whatever's in our decision space. Of all those decisions we have, we get to pick them, period. We have free will. Now, look at that three-year-old. Making the car go to the right toward the playground was not in their decision space. They couldn't do that. They did not have that as a decision. They can't choose that.
So they have free will to place intention.
Yes, they have free will to place intention.
But they're not guaranteeing that that intention is going to occur.
Well, not if it's not in their decision. It may not be a decision they have.
Right.
So sure, they can make an intention. I'd like to go to the parking lot, or I'd like to go to the playground. But that's just, you know, I wish. You know, that's, you can wish whatever you like. You certainly have free will to wish what you wish for. But when it comes to what you do, when you exercise that free will, that then is you choosing one of the things from your decision space that you can do. Now, that child may decide when the car goes left instead of right to scream and holler and pitch a fit, or the child may just say, okay, I accept that. We're going another direction. Now, that is in the child's decision space.
Yeah, that's observation,
that
right. Uh-huh. He chooses to observe and say, okay, submission.
Right.
Okay. All right. Does everyone see the same movie?
Does that mean do we all share the same reality?
Do we all see green trees? Or is the green the same to everybody?
Well, of course not.
I mean, forget about color blindness and stuff like that.
We won't talk about those details. But no, everyone, this is our physical reality, what we call physical reality, is a virtual reality. Okay, it's nothing but data. We take data in through our senses. We interpret that data to be this physical reality. There's nothing there but data. Okay, now, that being the case,
does that mean math doesn't really exist?
No, there is no such thing as this physical reality doesn't exist. None of this reality frame, I shouldn't say it doesn't exist, it exists as data.
Right.
You know, it exists as information. It doesn't exist as mass, this hard stuff, and the rest of it. That is just the data that we're getting. Okay, we get the data. So we look at a mass, that comes into our eyes, let's say, as light. And that light turns into electrical signals. Electrical signals bump neurons. The neurons, you know, then get interpreted as to what that means and how it works, and we touch it and we feel it and we push it and we say, ah, that's mass. That's an interpretation from the data we get. Everything we get is just data.
Okay.
So no, there is no mass. There's just the perception of mass. It's
now, how is that data? How does it exist? Does it exist in frequency? And I hate to use this word frequency, but I don't know what other word to use. But, like frequencies, impulses, stochastic resonances. How does it exist?
No, it doesn't exist as any of those things that you mentioned. And the reason that doesn't is that all those things are words that define things here in this physical reality frame, which has its own rule set. The rule set in this reality frame is physics. That's the rule set. So those things, frequency has a meaning here in this reality according to our rule set. It's something that changes in time, you know, it has a frequency. You know, how many times per second does something happen?
Mm-hmm.
That's its frequency. So that doesn't really translate when you're talking about a non-physical information field. And, of course, you know, that brings up the point that information itself is non-physical. You know, you can have a book, and the book has ink, and the book has paper, but those things are physical. But the message, the content, the information is non-physical. It takes a consciousness to get the message. So, you know, to answer your question, well, tell me your question again.
I'm not sure enough.
Let me focus on that again.
How does an individual or mass how do people or beings or conscious entities in physical reality receive information from consciousness, or I call it the ground of all being, that original source? How do they get it? How do they receive it? And we know brain interprets it, but how does it come in as what?
Okay.
That's the only way I know how to ask it.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. No, and I just said it's not frequency. It's not any of the things. What it is just information. So think of this larger consciousness system. Okay. Now we're just a part of that. We're a subset of that larger consciousness system, and so is everybody else. Our reality is information that we get. We think we get it in through our senses. What happens is we're consciousness. We're all netted together. The larger consciousness system sends us a data stream. That data stream defines all the things that, all the data that we get from our senses. We interpret that as this physical reality, and we're getting the data through our senses. Think of it this way. If you were put in a perfect sensory deprivation tank to where you had no data coming in at all, you'd just be floating in blackness and silence. Okay, now if you were in that tank and somebody could stimulate your brain, could put little signals and neurons in your brain in just the way that is happening right now while we're talking on the phone, you would hear and see just what you're seeing and hearing right now. Okay, and you couldn't tell the difference. Well, now think of you as consciousness. You're like in there's no sensory input. You're just consciousness, but you're getting this data stream that defines this reality. So how do we get it? We're part of it. We are consciousness, and we're part of that consciousness system. We're just a subset, and we're all netted. So that's how we get it. It's one piece of the consciousness informing another with a data stream that turns into this reality.
I'm only going to ask you questions like this for a few more minutes. I'm going to give you the rest of the show to talk about what you want to talk about.
Well, you just ask all the ones that you want. We'll just keep going.
Why is it that there are fundamentalists who say it is this way and you got to be saved or you got to whatever it is, okay? Just fundamentalism. And then why is it that a few years down the road you get that feeling where you know there's something more and you start expanding, and then one day you have this boom, this spontaneous thing that happens to you? What's happening there?
Well, first of all, that fundamentalism is a product of belief. Belief is a limiter. In as much as that you have a belief, then you have a block toward actually knowing. So that's how that process starts. But we're in this consciousness system that's trying to evolve, and we are part of that evolutionary process, and the consciousness system is kind of wants us to succeed. It bumps us and nudges us to evolve, to grow, to become more loving. So we're directed in that way. We have intuition that leads us in that way.
Is there some science, though, as to why that happens? You know, like when Edgar Mitchell came back from the moon, boom, he woke up when he saw the Earth. What is there some science that supports why that happens?
Well, the science that supports it is really the understanding of what we're here for, why we're here, how we work, and how we interact with the larger consciousness system. If you understand those things, then you know exactly why you go boom. You are, you know, this is part of your evolution. This is what you're here for, to grow up, to get the bigger picture, to not to be trapped in beliefs. And this is a learning lab. That's what this physical reality is. You're here to do that evolution, make that process. So you already come here with the desire and the inclination to do that, to grow. So everybody's kind of leaning in that direction, and sometimes it just takes a bump to have things fall together a little bit. And sometimes that bump is that the system does something that forces you to realize that reality is bigger than just the physical.
What do you know what it is that's in that system that's bumping?
It's the innate drive to evolve.
I mean, is it entropy
to decrease the entropy of the system. Okay. Now, I use entropy as a physics term, but basically that means to grow the system in its knowledge, in its organization, to make the system better. And what that translates to, that most of your listeners can relate to, is a low entropy consciousness is love. So you're growing toward love. You're growing toward kindness and caring and that sort of thing. That's when you take an information system like consciousness, that's how it evolves toward lower entropy. So yes, the system is evolving toward lowering its entropy, and that's what's pushing us.
Okay. I'm going to read you something out of your book, and I want you to, and I think that I was reading this when you were talking about how to change your movie that you're in, if you don't like it. You said, the organizational energy that created the peak in the first place must first be dissipated in order to remove or reduce that event expectation value. So tell us how we can, what does that mean scientifically, so that we so that people will understand they really can change their path, and how do we do that?
Okay, well, first you have to understand the way consciousness works. And very quickly, consciousness has a process of which it generates these virtual realities, and part of that process is that there is a probable future database. That's all the things that we could do and the probability that we will do them. Okay, there are also historical databases, but this is part of its process of generating this virtual reality. So there's all this probability out there of what might happen next, what we might do. And you can affect that probability with your mind. You can make that more or less probable if you focus your intent on it, because it hasn't happened yet. Free will takes place in the present. That's when we actually make our decisions, and we can do whatever we please. We don't have to follow what's probable. This has everything and its probability. So if there's, let's say, an illness is probable, or let's say you have a, you know, you have a knot someplace, and it's a probable tumor, then you can change that by changing the probabilities with your intent. Intent changes probability. Now, that is science in the sense, what I'm telling you is the same thing that quantum mechanics talks about when they say that particles are probability. They're just statistical distributions. They're probability distributions. And when you make a measurement, you get an answer. It collapses. They say the wave function collapses to a physical state. Well, that's the way the whole world works. It's not just quantum applied to little things. The whole reality system works that way. Quantum physics is just one little piece of it.
Okay.
So you have this probability statistical distribution of what's going to happen next. You can affect it. And as you make the measurement and collapse it into reality, you can collapse it toward a direction that you would like it to go.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to address Jack Turner's things, because he's emailing me and he's dying to hear your answer on these things.
All right.
I have noticed in the past couple of months that I will be doing something, and this fleeting thought will randomly run through, and it's very, very fleeting. I mean, it just flies by, and if I didn't know what I knew, I would let it go. But I've started paying attention to that fleeting thing. Go check this thing, go check that file, go do this thing, go do that thing. And I've noticed if I catch that fleeting millisecond thought and pay attention to it, every single time it's been right. So it makes me wonder if there's not, and it's always usually it'll be good for 2 or 3 days. You know, the information that I get from it will be valid for 2 or 3 days. So I wonder, is that the real window of free will?
Well, there is no window on free will. Free will is your freedom to choose from the choices you have. Now, what you're experiencing with those little messages that you're getting is that there is a, you know, you are in communication, as is everyone, all the time with the larger system. The system is a very, what can we say, it wants us to succeed, so it is trying to help us. It's trying to give us every opportunity that it can for us to grab those opportunities and grow with them. One of the ways it interacts with you and lets you know there's a larger reality and helps you see bigger pictures is by giving you this information, and you have the sensitivity to actually bring it up into your intellect. Everybody gets that kind of information, but they don't have the clarity, they don't have the low noise consciousness, they're not in tune enough to actually get it into their intellect. You do, and you've learned to pay attention to it. I have too. I get the same sort of things. We call that intuition, but that intuition, and some people will call it their guides. And the intuition and your guides are just metaphors for your interface into the larger consciousness system. So it's not a matter of a window on free will. You can make a choice of all the choices you have, like that three-year-old didn't have a choice to go right, but had a choice whether to cry or not. You can make all the choices you have, and you have the free will to do that. And if you pay attention, you will notice that the system is always nudging you kind of in the right direction. That's where synchronicity comes from. Those are nudges to open your mind, to get you moving, to help you out.
Okay. Okay, let's talk to Jack, to John Turner. By the way, John's book, was it Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, for anybody out there that's interested in that. Here's Jack's question. Is it not easy to understand the world that we call waking life, as all of us are in the realm the most called death? Wouldn't that explain everything? I'm not sure what he means by the word death there, but maybe you do since he sent you the email too.
All right, let me, I'm just pulling up that email that you sent me. What I have is, basically, what's your definition of dead?
That was me.
Ah, okay.
He sent this email, and that was what, so John, if you're listening, email us back so we get a better picture of what you're wanting us to know.
He says, I came across two patients last month who had escaped a terrible auto accident. Their response to that question, are you and I both dead now, was interesting.
Oh, he was talking about that movie. Hold on, let me get back up here and see what he said. You know that movie about the airplane crash and everybody died, but nobody realized that they were dead?
Yeah, I saw that movie. Mm-hmm.
That's what he's talking about. He wants to know, are we really dead and not know it? But I said, what is dead?
Yeah, well, dead is first of all, dead is in opposition to life in our words, right? You're either alive or you're dead, and those are opposites.
In reality, anyway.
Yeah, in this physical realm. Well, both are just virtual. There's neither one. Your consciousness, you join this reality frame, and then if you're here then, in an awareness reality frame, then language would say you're alive in this reality frame. When you leave this reality frame, you're still consciousness.
Right.
You're just no longer plugged into this reality frame. So there really is no such thing. From our viewpoint of this physical reality, there's really no such thing as alive or dead. You're neither. It's just a transition. It's a different data stream. So you have this data stream that now suddenly gives you this physical reality, and so you're in that reality, and then you're not getting that data anymore. You're not in that physical reality. So that's all dead is. You know, dead and alive are both virtual. You're virtually alive in this physical reality, and you're virtually dead, and both of them are just points of view. It's the kind of data that you're getting.
I totally agree. Body just drops away. Everything else is still there.
Sure.
So now I want to talk about your work. I want you to tell us, if you don't mind, about the research that you do with Binaural Beats and your partner, and how you both had out-of-body experiences and met on the other side, and the science that you think applies. That I'm really interested in the science, because everybody else in the world talks about the experiences, but people like you that can have some hard data behind it is important to bridging the gap.
Okay, well.
But I'd like for you to tell the story about meeting your buddy on the other in out of body. That was very
well. Those are some those things are some years old, but
and the binaural beats and the 4 hertz difference. I think that's very important too.
Okay, so these are all things out of the time when Dennis Menick and I were working at the laboratory that we helped Bob Monroe build and put together, and one of the things that actually Dennis discovered, he read it in a Scientific American written by a guy named Oster about binaural beats. And all a binaural beat is that you put a pure tone of a pure frequency in one ear, and you put another pure tone in the other ear. Of course, you need headphones to do this. And the second tone is just a few hertz off. That means a few cycles per second off from the first tone. So let's say you have a tone of, let's just easy numbers, like 100 hertz going in one ear and 104 hertz going in the other ear. Well, what they found out is that those two tones would meet at the corpus callosum. Okay, there'd be oscillations. Of course, the sound turns into electrical signals, turns into neurons, but they're all oscillating at this frequency. And at the corpus callosum, which is the membrane between the two hemispheres of the brain, you would get a beat frequency, and you could actually hear that beat frequency, even though there was no sound beating in the air, or it wasn't being conducted through the head. They eliminated those variables. you could actually perceive the beat frequency beating in the corpus callosum of the brain. Well, Dennis read that, and he said, neat, maybe that will be something that will help us, drive brainwaves into particular altered states of consciousness. That's what we were studying at the time with Bob. We knew from Bob's experience that just about the time he would exit out of body, he would get these around 4 hertz, they're actually about 3.8 hertz oscillations. He'd feel his whole body shaking at about that frequency. So we thought maybe if we could
say that again, what was the frequency?
It was about 3.8 hertz. That's hertz is a word for cycles per second. Mm-hmm. So we just call that 4. It's real close to 4 hertz.
Would it make a difference?
That was just a thing he felt. Every time just before he'd go out of body, he'd feel himself oscillating at about 4 hertz. So we wanted to know whether or not we could produce that state. Now, we had EEG on people's, sensors on people's scalps, and we were measuring what their brain waves were. And we kind of got the idea that Bob dropped into a theta state, and a theta state is about 4 hertz. At least 4 hertz is in the theta region. Alpha, is when you're kind of in a meditation state. Beta is when we're awake like we are now. And then theta is when you're, delta is when you're unconscious. But this theta state is in that 4 hertz region. So we kind of thought that maybe that pulsation had to do with an EEG of around 4 hertz, and we wanted to be able to reproduce that in people so that we would make them go into that altered state of consciousness and could measure it. So Dennis and I, tested it out. He got the equipment, and he made the first tape, and we listened to it, and wow, it was really powerful. It puts you into an altered state immediately, into a theta state, which is a very, very good altered state of consciousness, something that meditators often will meditate for decades to learn to put themselves in a steady, solid theta state at about 4 hertz. So that's where all that came about, and that is actually the core technology that's now called HemiSync, that Monroe Laboratories, mm-hmm. TMI, that they use in their processes. So that's where HemiSync came from. Actually, it was a discovery that Dennis noticed, and he and I kind of worked out together, and it really was a driver. When you'd put that on, the EEG would show a dominance of theta state brainwaves. And it also would show that the two hemispheres became synchronized. That's why they call it HemiSync. Instead of having random firings of the brain all the time, suddenly they'd settle down into a nice synchronized 4 hertz pattern. So that forces an altered state that's very productive. And that was a good technology. So the story you want me to tell...
And we've got about 12 minutes.
Talk fast.
Yeah.
The story was it's kind of my aha moment, because even though I was doing all this stuff and I was collecting data, and we had data saying it was 1 in a million that the information we were getting could have just been by chance. So we knew something was going on. But you don't really pay much attention to that. You say, yeah, okay, something's going on, but it's different. You get it at the intellectual level, but you don't get it at the gut level until something really just hits you between the eyes. And for me, one night Bob told us, Dennis and I want you guys to both go out of body, meet in the space up above the lab, and then go on an adventure together. So we did that, and he had a microphone at each of us. We were in isolation chambers, so there was no sound between us. There was total isolation, and he would then ask us, where are you, what are you doing, what do you see, what's going on now? And he was asking that of me and of Dennis separately. Of course, we couldn't hear each other. And we were talking to him and telling him that we'd go out in body, and he'd ask us. He taught us to be able to report back while we were out of body. And so after about, an hour and a half, 2 hours of this, Dennis and I tumble out of these booths, and we go up, and there was Bob with this grin on his face. And he says, well, do you guys really think you were together? And we look at each other and said, yeah, it was kind of a wild ride. We did a lot of things, met a lot of people, had a lot of conversations. So he said, well, listen to this. And he flipped on my tape, and he flipped on Dennis's tape at the same time. Now, these are two individual tapes have been recorded by two individual people who couldn't hear each other. And there were Dennis and I on this tape talking to each other, answering each other's questions, talking to the other same individuals, seeing the same things. And my mouth dropped open and hit the floor, and I kind of wandered in the daze for the next 3 weeks saying, my God, it's real, because that was something I could not deny. That was something that was, you know, wasn't just data. I didn't just read numbers off a blackboard. I didn't just heal someone or do that kind of thing where it's just statistics. This was different. So that was kind of a big turning point for me as far as my understanding of the larger reality.
I think it's an amazing story. Okay, I got another question in the email.
All right.
And we only have a couple of minutes, like 2 or 3 minutes left. Go ahead. Let him in. Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, this is Ernie.
Oh, hey, Ernie, I was just about to read your question. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi, Ernie.
How are you? My question, Tom, has, I guess, insinuates free will. We talked about, do the current choices we make affect or alter this overall global field of consciousness, you know, including what these new souls will draw from that have not yet been born? So I make a choice, good or bad, I guess what I'm asking at an individual level of consciousness, do I affect that global field of consciousness? Because I obviously was drawing from something, previous field. So does what I do affect that, and also these new souls who you have yet to draw from this pool?
Well, yes. What happens is that we are part of the larger system's evolution. So we're evolving individually, but the larger system is evolving partly because we are evolving. In other words, the whole system is trying to reduce its entropy. If we reduce our entropy, we're a part of that system. If we reduce our entropy a little bit, then the whole system has its entropy reduced a little bit. So yes, everything you learn, if you grow up, if you become a little closer to being love, then the whole system benefits by that, because you're part of that system. You're not a separate thing. You and that system are one, and as you grow, the system grows. As you evolve, it evolves.
So it could be said there's an ascending nature of consciousness in a way.
There's a what?
In other words, consciousness is there's an ascending evolution to consciousness.
Yes, ascending. I couldn't hear that word, yes. I thought you said offending, and that didn't make sense, but okay.
No, I'm sorry. Ascending, yep.
Yes, and that's because it's evolving. You think of evolution as kind of an ascending process. It's got direction. It's going someplace, and in this case, entropy is the measure of that evolution. And yes, the whole system is growing.
Well, thank you for your answer, Anita. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome, Ernie. Ernie, I think you met him Tom. I think you met Ernie when he went to Alabama. Didn't you guys have lunch?
I did. Yeah.
That's Ernie. Yeah,
we had a delightful lunch together.
He's a good guy. Okay, anything that you want to talk about that we've not already talked about? We should have 8 minutes. I was confused when that beep started coming through.
Okay.
We should have 8 minutes.
8 minutes? Oh, gee, you can ask another 5 questions in 8 minutes, Eva. Well, one thing I would like to say is that coming up February the 20th and 21st, I have a workshop in Campbell, California, which is near San Jose, and then the next weekend after that, February 27th and 28th, I have another workshop coming up in Costa Mesa, right next to the border of Costa Mesa and Irvine, California.
Jim Beal, by the way, called me today and said, I just want to make sure that you know that Tom Campbell is going to be at Monroe Institute on March 19th or whatever day.
Right, middle of March. I'm the keynote speaker for their professional workshop, and then I've got another workshop going on in New York, May the 1st and 2nd. And those workshops, we talk a lot about the theory, you know, what reality is, how it works, why it works that way. We do some science. I show how you can use this reality system to derive both quantum mechanics and relativity, something that physicists don't know how to do now. So you can do physics with this, as well as metaphysics. It derives both. It's one arching understanding that will let you derive physics and metaphysics. So that gives me some sense that it must have something to it, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to answer physics questions with it.
And you're at mybigtoe.com, or is
right.
there a dash in there somewhere?
That's well, I'm at mybigtoe. That'll work. If you go to www.mybigtoe.com, you can find out about me and my books and so on. And if you go to www.mbtevents.com, that's you can find out about the workshops. They have all that information. So it's mybigtoe.com or mbtevents.
Okay, since we have about 5 minutes now, I'm going to ask a couple more questions, if that's okay.
Okay, let's get back to those questions.
If time doesn't exist, how is it that we perceive it?
Oh, but time does exist. Time is more fundamental than space. Time exists. And
okay, then I have a question. Why does every other physicist say time doesn't exist?
Because they don't understand.
Okay. explain it, please, if you can, in a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah, it's not something you can explain easy in a few minutes, but time is an entropy reducer for information, because now you can take information and you can sequence it. You can have patterns that are sequenced, which is lower entropy than not. So time is a fundamental attribute that consciousness has evolved, just like it's evolved, broken itself into pieces to help us interact. It is fundamental. Now, the time that we experience here in this physical reality is not fundamental. This time is manufactured. And every reality system that I've been to has its own time. They're all manufactured to meet its own needs. So time in the various reality frames think of it as a simulation, and you have the outer loop, delta T, incrementing time every time you go around and update the simulation by a tiny increment. So each reality frame has its own delta T outer loop that's driving that data stream we talked about that creates the perception of the reality. So time is not fundamental to this reality frame, but time is fundamental to the system.
Okay, so time, in physical reality, it's right now time. We can't go back to yesterday, and we can't go tomorrow. But in different, I don't know if it's dimensions or parallel universes, what is, by the way, your distinction between the two of those?
Dimensions and parallel universes?
Uh-huh.
There's a big difference there. Dimensions, I see it like in terms of reality frames. You know, there is no really separator. It's all consciousness. It's all this big consciousness system. We're all one within this system. And you have various subsets of the system, and these subsets have their own rule sets. The rule sets then define reality frames. And reality frames, you can call them different dimensions, but they're just subsets of consciousness with their own rule sets and their own time base. So that's one sense of dimensions. When you talk about like the many worlds theory of quantum mechanics and parallel universes, that's basically comes from a completely different thing. That's saying that the state in which physical matter can be in has a lot of different states it can be in, and for every state there is another physical universe that's parallel to this one. And as it turns out, that's, you know, it's figuratively true, but it's not actually true. Those parallel universes only exist as data in databases. They're fixed. They don't, they're not like the beings in those parallel universes have free will. They're just talking about the past databases. And in the future, I told you we have this probable future database, you have these past databases, and that's where this concept of parallel universes comes from, because you have all of that, everything that could have happened does happen, which is kind of what the many worlds people say, but it's just a database.
When you say that, are you meaning the parallel universes aren't active? Like we, that's a hard way.
Like we are? Exactly.
Yeah.
They're
okay.
Not. They're not active like we are. They're not populated by beings with free will. They're just...
It's residual memories are...
it's just data. It's just information. That's the information of everything that could have happened but didn't.
Oh, okay.
Now it's there, and it's modeled, so you can go into it, and it's just like a movie, just like being there. You can interact with those beings, you can talk with them, you can say, play what-if games, what if we change this, what would happen? You can do all that sort of thing, but it's just a very good database.
Now, we got really no time, but I'm going to take it anyway since Don started us late. I have to ask you this. When you used the binaural beats and you went out of body, or even if you didn't use the binaural beats and you went out of body, but let's just use that, is there a precaution?
Well, to your listeners, and to make it really quick, one, I don't use binaural beats anymore. Binaural beats are like training wheels. They help you get there the first couple of times, but eventually they become a trap, just like meditation or anything else. You have to let it go. You have to grow beyond that. But anyway, is there a caution? The only caution is get rid of your fear. If you carry fear on that trip, you're likely to find things that you won't like. But that's because you bring the fear to the problem.
So you create what your thoughts create, so you see what the thing, the fears that you create, is that what it is?
That all happens, yes. Now, there is a objective world out there. So the data isn't all coming from you, but you do create what's in your mind and your fears. When you get into that particular reality frame, which is called the astral Hinduism, yes, you create. If you have fear there, you will create fears. If you're afraid
of going
there.
Kind of like a bad drug trip, right?
Yes, it'll be like, yeah, but that's because of your fear. So first, get rid of all your fear. Try to get rid of your ego. Try to become love, and then you will find a very pleasant trip.
Okay, one more question. It's 8:57. We got till 9 o'clock.
Good.
That's what I'm going to take anyway. We might get cut off. I'm of the opinion through my experiences that we created today what we're experiencing at this very moment in the past sometime, maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years, the life we're living today, not necessarily this instant. How far in the future, I mean, what are we creating today? How far down the road? 6 months, a year, a day, 2 hours? Do you have any idea? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, but it goes for as long as you want. You know, the choices we make today will influence the probabilities of what's going to happen tomorrow. So if you go walk to your neighbor's house and throw a rock through their window tonight, it's going to affect what's going to happen to you tomorrow. The choices you make will affect what happens in the future. Now, that can be run out to, as far in the future as you wish. It's just the further out you get, the more ratty it is, the bigger the error bars. So you can run it out as far as you want, but there are error bars there. So yeah, everything we do affects our choices. And then we have new choices, and we make those choices, and that affects other choices. That's called causality. You know, one thing causes the next. And there is, that can be run out as far, but it's not deterministic. It's not like those things have to happen that way. We have choices.
Does your cohesiveness of mind make a difference? When you're
Absolutely.
Thinking the thought, the cohesive state, the stickiness of it?
Absolutely. I call that focus. The difference is that if you're a normal person on a normal day, their mind is all over the place. They have all sorts of thoughts going on. That's noise. When you learn to meditate or when you learn to focus your intent is very clean and pure and focused. And at that point, you can really modify those probabilities. You can change things. You are consciousness. Without that, it's...
Okay, I got to go. My producer just beeped in, so I got to get off of here.
All right.
You have to come back. You have to come back.
Pull up the big hook and drag us off.
Thanks, Tom. I'll talk to you later. Have a good one.
You're welcome, Eva.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.